the three things that were missed from my perspective. Tesla showcased a teleoperated humanoid robot that has use cases already. And I think that a lot of people are stuck on this thing has to be full AI. And I agree, full AI is going to be the best use case. But literally the entire event was like, hey, check out this army of robots where we obviously have people controlling them in some respects, right? They probably have a button for forward, backwards, left and right, and some canned responses. But you could tell that somebody was controlling it. But that opens up a whole conversation around, wow, okay, so now you could start leveraging humans to multiply their ability to do physical work through teleoperation. So that's number one. But there's a lot to talk about there. Number two, Tesla Robotaxi. They unveiled it as a driverless, no steering wheel and pedal vehicle. But I am really stuck on the form factor because the way the car looks, which looks, in my opinion, looks beautiful, is still shaped like a regular car for the most part. It doesn't have a piece of glass in the hatchback, in the rear trunk, and there's a hard separator between the trunk and the front cabin, but regulations don't require you to have a rear window as long as you have two side mirrors. So that seems road legal now, and if they were to add a steering wheel and pedal to that vehicle, all of a sudden you have a compact car. But there is some tweets from Matthew on X that says Lars and Franz said that they're not planning, that there's no plans to add steering wheel and pedal to the Robotaxi, to the Cybercab. But like that bothers me because that's the Cybercab. The compact car is a different product of the Cybercab. It just happens to use the same exact platform, but with steering wheel and pedals and side view mirrors, right? And then we get into the question of manufacturing, scale, CapEx, trying to align and line up the timing of getting your Robotaxi at full scale versus the jurisdictions that are going to approve it. There's going to be a huge gap in getting to full production and everyone approving it. So how best to leverage that manufacturing line is by pushing products out you can sell today. And if they can add a steering wheel pedal and side view mirrors, all of a sudden you have a line that cranks compact cars. And I get what they said, but it's like, so that's another thing too. And then three, that van, regardless of how insane it looks and ridiculous it looks, the use cases for that van reaffirms for me and gives me more confidence that Tesla's long-term plan with that product is similar to the airline model, which is they're going to build the shells, they're going to sell it to people, and then fleet providers, even in the event themselves, they said, we want people to buy multiple products and shepherd them like a shepherd with a sheep or her sheep. My apologies, all the female shepherds out there, okay?
So their sheep.
Thank you. So that means that Tesla is very much in the business of outsourcing fleet management. And with the van specifically, I think they're also going to outsource the layout of the interior. You can see that this thing has zero chance to be drivable. Like they're just saying, screw that. It's just a box on wheels, literally. But that opens up insane opportunities because now you have things like RVs. You have things like haulers of materials. You have things like minibuses. You have things like party buses. You have things like sleepers. And you have things like movable houses. I mean, and how that car or van looks needs to be customized for each one of those unique use cases because it has so much room. Like having a bus layout is a terrible waste of potential for any other use case you can have where this thing moves without a driver. And I think the ultimate model there is Tesla builds the shells, they sell it to fleet providers, they have to figure out the regulatory approvals and the hurdles, which is going to take years. But ultimately, this thing is like a product maybe in 2030 or 2029 or 2028, where you have a framework to build the buses like the airline model. You sell it to your Spirit, Virgin, United, American Airlines, United equivalent for fleet providing. They customize the interior and they put in the Tesla network exclusively to sell the product either through rideshare or a rental, or they sell them outright with the equipment, given that there's regulatory approval to do that, right? So those are the things that stick out. Those are the three things that stick out to me. Like, and I can't shake the feeling specifically around the teleoperation of the robot and the compact car which is really the robotaxi, but in under wraps. Like, it's being like, this is like a stealth reveal of that car. And there's a lot of variables as to why they wouldn't want to sell it now and open reservations, but I can't shake that. Those are the things that I just can't shake. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. Well, I want to start with the van first, just because I saw this here a few minutes ago, and I'll shout out Wizard of Doge is the one that I saw who found it. I'm sure there are others, but there were, you know, I've heard multiple reports from people that said that Franz talked about different interiors being available for the RoboVan. And this was an image that flashed on screen inside of the RoboVan. And for those who are struggling to understand the significance, this is an Optimus robot here. And it is changing the tire on a Model X out of a RoboVan that is titled Tesla Service on it. And the interior is outfitted as a mobile service van. So, like, this is specifically based on materials provided by the company in the thought process of what the future of the RoboVan looks like, which aligns very well with what you just said. You know, it's not just Tesla that will want to offer a service like this out of a platform like the RoboVan.
Right. Exactly. The use cases for this feel unlimited. And there's new TAMs that appear, new total addressable markets that appear by making this fully autonomous. You're essentially allowing everyone to have a minibus form factor. And when I mean minibus, I mean a literal bus that's smaller. You're allowing everyone to be able to have access to that as an alternative of for point A to point B transport, or as a straight up livable space. Like, the paradigm shifts. In addition to automating all the existing things we can think of now, right? There's two things going on here. You are automating the things that are going on now, which is transportation of goods from one place to another, and transportation of people from one place to another, which is like 99% of, let's say, vehicles on the road outside of, say, RVs, right? But you remove that variable, you can do that plus whatever else you want to do, right? Which is those other use cases that I brought up. You start, what percentage of the population is going to be like, holy crap, every time I go to the bar, okay, me and my buddies, we're going to hail the, you know, dope party van, and we're going to take it from freaking, you know, Waco, Texas, all the way down to Austin, Texas, even though it's an hour and a half drive, okay? Six of your buddies or 10 of your buddies, where you're going to get into this party bus and take it all the way down to Rainy Street or 6th Street, and the driving going to feel bad because you're going to be partying in that sucker. You're going to have a good time, and it's going to be extremely affordable because it's fully autonomous and it's electric, right?
Yeah, it'll be like $5 a person to go down there. I mean, we could do the math real quick. Elon said numbers related to the RoboVan specifically of 5 to 10 cents per mile. And that's
double it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I'm assuming that's 5 to 10 cents a mile per person. I could be wrong there. It could just be 5 to 10 cents a mile.
It would be per person, I think.
I think it would be per person. So, you know, if you had, it gets to be nutty cheap, and you can do all sorts of group activities, or, you know, have your own mobile office, mobile business, mobile living space. You know, all those use cases are obviously like front and center.
Even just like suburbia to the city center. Like, if you take freaking the outskirts of Dallas, or the outskirts of Orlando, or the outskirts of New York, or whatever city that would be able to like realistically use this, right? Which is many of them. Usually people in suburbia don't really go into the city, number one, because it takes time, it's expensive, they got to drive, and then if they're trying to go to the bar, they have to hail a taxi or go with somebody, right? So it introduces a lot of variability, plus you're stuck in a car, right? With this thing, even if you have to drive 20 miles, and let's say in a worst case scenario, it's 20, 30, 40 cents per person per mile, right? A 10 mile trip would be roughly $2 or $4. And then a 20 mile trip would be $8. So people would pay $8 to go in and out of the city about half an hour to 45 minutes away. And they get a gigantic amount of entertainment and they get to go with their friends and no one has to worry about driving. And how much does it cost to offer something like that? That shell is probably like 40 grand, 45 grand.
It's more to build something like that. But yeah, it's definitely
not prohibitive.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So everything changes. And then RVs get disrupted because of this thing, obviously. Obviously. RVs are completely disrupted. You know, that's like this literally a house on wheels.
Yeah, it's certainly a disruptive factor.
Yeah.
In RVs.
Just years out.
Thinking about the conversation with Pierre, the challenge that you're articulating about lining up all of the, you know, the manufacturing ramp of the vehicles along with, you know, matching your supply and matching your demand and figuring out the technology piece of robotaxi. And then to Pierre's point, I tend to think this is very important for retail investors to think about in assessing whether they have the risk tolerance and the time horizon to stay invested in Tesla is that scale out piece. Like, not can, you know, just saying that Tesla can build robotaxis and build them at scale and the regulatory environment be, you know, willing to accept them is not in and of itself saying that Tesla wants to or is capable of operating fleets of millions of cars on the road at scale. Like, there's a lot of complexity in offering ride hail as a service in a city at scale, the way that Uber has, that has, you know, is far beyond just the complexity of the driver that's driving the vehicle around. And will they be able to get to that stage where there's millions of robotaxis on the ground and they're, you know, growing the fleet by millions of vehicles every year? In 2 years from now, like, I think that's highly unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
And 5 years from now, maybe. Like, I think that that's one of those reasonably possible that we could see that end of the decade coming into 2030. We may not be able to get there. Like, there's still a Herculean lift between here and there, even though the progress of FSD itself is incredible. Like, you know, there's a number of bottlenecks that, you know, any technological project can run into. And when you solve one, that doesn't mean you're free and clear to the finish line. That just means that now you have to go solve the next bottleneck.
Right.
And then when you solve that one, then you have to go solve the next one. And so, you know, there are bottlenecks behind the bottlenecks that we're facing today. And it's easy to think, oh, you know, as soon as we turn on the, you know, Cortex cluster in Austin and we can just double our training and inference and test compute and all this stuff, that like, poof, like from here to commercial robotaxi rollout is, you know, 6 months. And I just don't think that that's a reasonable expectation. But that said, Tesla has an incredible track record of accomplishing things that people said were impossible just, you know, a little bit later than the most optimistic among us would have hoped. And I see clear and steady and continued progress. And I'm super excited to see how they manage this transition into the next sets of vehicles and what those, you know, how we will get a lot of clarity in the first half of next year, assuming that they do deliver on the timeline that Elon said, of whatever these intermediate new models are that are in between the current Model 3 and Y and the Cybercab platform. And that's supposed to get us to 3 million units capacity on, you know, just using our existing factories compared to the 2 million year or units per year capacity that we have right now. So it's, you know, a 50% increase without bringing another new factory online. And the distance in between whatever those new models look like and the Cybercab will tell you, you know, how close we are to that next generation vehicle and like compact steering wheel and pedals cars versus not.
So the thing you were talking about around the timing of the full fleet of robotaxis that are self-driving is going to take a long time, like true, fully self-driving, no steering wheel and pedal, for it to propagate everywhere that it makes sense and they can uphold the production capability to be able to do that and push enough cars through the lines for it to make sense, right? And for it to get approved. I agree that that's going to take a minute, which is why the biggest question I have is then why show it now? Why show it now? Right? Like why try to come out and show it on 8.8 and then miss the deadline and then try to show it in 10.10? Clearly you're trying to show something, right? So it's like, okay, like I can't shake that. And again, I could be optimistic and I could be thinking too positively about the potential outcome next year with the first half. And I'm definitely not trying to do that because I agree with you. I think we're back to this discussion from like 2016, 2017, 2018. If you follow the Tesla story closely, the stock and the company are two different things, right? They are two different things. And when I talk about this, I talk about the company. I don't talk about the stock because the stock's going to do whatever it does. And what the stock's going to do, my guess, not financial or investment advice, is that it's not going to like the next 6 to 12 months. Even potentially even more, because there's nothing laid out from what Wall Street likes to see that gives them a clue from a timing perspective and a profitability perspective. That we've got nothing yesterday. Even if they said Texas, California, 2025, okay, how many cars are you doing a supervised? Is that a test fleet? How many rides are you going to do? You know what I'm saying? Like there's still cloudiness behind it. There's a lot of cloudiness behind it. So from that perspective, I agree. But like from the perspective of like, hey, here's like the very obvious roadmap that Tesla is going to do, to your point of from a technology perspective, they've outlined exactly what they're going to do. No one else is doing this. No one else is doing this. And so if they can, the question becomes an execution thing. Remember Dave Lee talking about this in his videos for years, right? And he was 100% on. All that matters is execution. The concept works. The business model works. The type of products you're introducing works. The markets that you're selling into works, right? Everything's aligned. It's just doing it. You just got to do it, you know?
And in doing it, you know that you're going to run into hiccups and, you know, minor failures. But the biggest thing to look for is zoom out and say, are we continuing to make steady progress? And I feel like we 100% are continuing to make steady progress. And I think that, you know, a big part of why show the event is to allow the team to share the results of like so many different parts of the Tesla team got to show off to their friends and family the incredibly cool shit that they've been working so hard on for so long. And it is, you know, a waypoint that Elon is pointing towards. This is what the future looks like. You know, it's that let's come back as a team and remember what is the future. Like, let's put a stake in the ground and let's imagine what the future looks like, you know, 10 years from now, if we're successful. And yes, it's like a small scale version of that, but you know, and this will get more towards the bots, but it's still, you know, a world where no humans were driving cars anywhere in this hypothetical imaginary world. And it's a world where humans and Optimus robots are sharing space and interacting and, you know, in like, I think the purpose of the teleoperation for the bots was to really provide the C-3PO R2-D2 experience that he was talking about, which is what he's driving the Optimus team towards. Like, those person-to-person relationship interactions, talking to the bot and having it really talk to you like a human would, because, you know, in reality, that's probably an actual human that's on the other side of it, which, you know, is huge that they can accomplish that with like no, like there's a huge technical accomplishment in being able to teleoperate the bot in that real, you know, that quickly, in real time, and have such a natural interaction. You know, we'll set that part of the conversation aside for a little bit later overall.
Well, let's get into it now. Let's get into it now. Yeah, because I agree. And like, when you say that, what I think is, so what comes to mind is like, yeah, there is a 5, 10, 20 year vision that says this is what the world's going to look like. And this is what we're building towards. But what does Tesla do better than anyone else is that they know how to monetize the road there. They know how to monetize the road there. FSD is the perfect example. Even their electric vehicles are a perfect example. Because what are the electric vehicles really doing? They are building out the supply chain foundation for the next generation of energy transportation and energy generation systems. That's why the cars are there from the very beginning, is to get enough demand for batteries so that the costs come down and they can start putting freaking batteries everywhere. Okay? And then to get to a self-driving future, what do you need to do? You need to get the data needed to get the cars to drive themselves. How do you do that? You slap the self-driving software in the cars you sell now, and then you don't turn it on until you are comfortable that you have everything you need. And then you literally, your customer base becomes the data gathering tool and the profitability tool so that you can justify keep making cars, and you get the data and the public benefits from the progress of that technology, right? To me, the bot's going to benefit from the same exact thing. It's obvious from watching that the presentation, right? If I go and pull up a snippet from that presentation, and we look at what the bot was doing. So what is Tesla doing, right? Tesla is showing that this robot can do tasks, even if it's teleoperated, to your point, right? Even if it's teleoperated and somebody on the other side doing something, that is clearly a useful thing to do. Pick thing up, move it. Pick thing up, move it. Okay, cool. So what is a realistic way of executing this where you can start monetizing this now so you can start ramping up the supply chain needed to make millions of these per year and get the data you need to actually do those movements? You start using these in commercial applications, starting with Tesla, with a teleoperator that steps in when the robot doesn't do the movement correctly, utilizing artificial intelligence. Literally exactly what the cars are doing now. It's an exception-based data gathering system so that the human or robot can be fully autonomous in the long term. And how do you do the exception gathering? You start using it in your manufacturing process, right? You start... and there's the robotaxi. you start using it in your manufacturing process so that the person that's teleoperating, let's say that person is in charge of 5 robots or even 10 robots. When the robot fails and it sends a ding to the VR headset of the person or whatever, hey, there's an error. Can you help me? The person going in and doing the movements they were doing with these robots, that is the exception gathering process that gets sent to the mothership AI cluster of training. They use that to make it better. And then you start deleting errors. You start deleting bugs. And then you're like, okay, so this works now in a mass manufacturing setting. We feel like we have 99.999% of the movements figured out. Let's start selling it to other auto manufacturers. Let's start selling it to any manufacturing company. And then what you say is like, hey, we'll, you know, you can buy 10 of these. And for each 10, we recommend you buy at least one tracking system so that you can manage the exceptions properly. And then that teleoperator becomes a job for this robot in the early stages. And then you keep introducing it to more and more use cases, right? And then that's how you create the automation over and over and over again. But what this means is that this right here, you don't wait until it's fully autonomous to monetize it. You can monetize it the second you feel that the movements and your teleoperation is successful 99.99999% of the time, and there is a market that would benefit from this tremendously, where they can cut their physical labor overhead by half or by 10x, whatever that number is. And then businesses care about profits first and foremost, right? How is this not going to have incredible demand even as a teleoperated a thing? And the fact that they had it there walking around people, even if it's teleoperated, y'all, what that means is that they're comfortable with this thing not killing somebody. They would not have done this unless they were like, man, this thing kind of falls over sometimes. That would be a disaster. They had 2 people passing out just from being there. That's why it was late. Imagine the bot starts like falling on people and someone's got their kit there or whatever, or they're like, you know, a shorter person and this thing just falls on them and then they fall and they hit their head and God forbid something terrible happens. They knew the risk. They literally brought in 2,500 people, Hans. They brought in 2,500 people and unleashed robots everywhere. And they're like, yeah, just, we're comfortable. What does that say? In a manufacturing setting that's super controlled, like the risk of something happening there is 100 times less than what they just showed at the event.
Yeah, so there's the unit economics part is super key in the scenario that you just laid out. And I think, you know, it's easy to assume that we are at the, you know, one person per potentially multiple bots point, but we'll zoom out and step away from Tesla at this point in time, and I'll transition over to thinking about Figure Robotics. We know from the conversation that Brett Adcock had with Herbert and with Scott Walter the other day that, you know, they were talking about a lot of these exact challenges, and their Figure One, you know, the first version of their humanoid robot prototype, like, it took tons of engineers and then operators and everything just to get it to kind of do a task every now and then. And so you're talking about like the people that work on the actuators who are highly paid and, you know, all these people to make this super complicated machine. But that's because the first one, you know, they're just trying to figure out how to make it, and they haven't figured out how to make it reliable and scalable and manufacturable. And so, you know, it's the version of the Waymo where, you know, there's an engineer who gets paid $150,000 a year who's sitting in the driver's seat, like, except times multiples of that for your first one. Then once you go and you fix that one and you do your design revisions and you figure out how to make it way more reliable and robust, well, then maybe you can get it down to the point where you've got a team of 2 or 3 humans per robot. And then, like, the next one, maybe it's 1 human per robot. And then maybe, you know, at some point in the future, you can have multiple robots, tens of robots, 100 robots at some point deep into the future, and 1 human kind of supervisor. And that's the path that, you know, Tesla is also on. I don't know, you know, where along that spectrum they are today. Because, I mean, one of the things that was obvious from the watching the interaction, because of specifically the safety point that you were picking out, that each Optimus robot had at least one, and it looked to me in most cases, multiple Tesla employees that were physically present to help. And now that's not really all to help just with the robot. It's also to help with managing the crowd through robot interactions and everything. So it's not, I'm not saying that every Optimus robot right now takes, you know, five Tesla employees to operate. But in the situation that we saw yesterday, we definitely know there's at least one teleoperator per any of those ones that were doing lots of those cool, like, next level interactions. There were definitely Optimus robots doing 100% fully autonomous stuff that was awesome too. But the, like, most impressive interactions with people were more than likely, you know, handled by teleoperation. And so you have that teleoperator, and then in a lot of the cases you also have a employee or two. Potentially you also had an engineer that's kind of there with the teleoperator helping gather data from the Optimus robot and make sure that, you know, if they're seeing anything that's of concern from the sensor suite on board, that, okay, that Optimus gets escorted, you know, back behind curtains and taken out from in front of everybody. But there's probably, you know, a little bit of support staff that's going on there. But what an incredibly complex set of interactions and an environment to put Optimus in. And to your point, like, I think that their willingness to put that many robots in that close of proximity to that many people doing that many different things, like, the complexity of the Optimus demonstration yesterday was next level. And I think most people are just going to think, oh, there was teleoperation there. And they're just going to use that as an excuse to dismiss the whole thing and not appreciate the refinement of the Optimus platform from a physical, like the robotic standpoint purely, for it to be able to do all that stuff and none of them to just, like, completely break down and, you know, have a little robot seizure in front of everybody, caught on cell phone and blasted to the world. Oh, Tesla's a complete failure. That's a huge success. They were operating for, you know, several hours in front of people as well. Like, that is super impressive. All of the fact that they're able to do lots of things autonomously, super impressive.
Yeah.
Like, there are just so many. When you understand how hard it is to solve the Optimus challenge, and you start thinking through, wow, there's a lot of those things that they ticked off and that they showed yesterday. And it's incredible progress. And, you know, like, we haven't seen a demonstration like that from literally any other humanoid robotics company. Unitree has showed some cool stuff. Figure has showed some cool stuff. Like, there's a lot of cool demonstrations. There is not a single humanoid robotic demonstration that is on par with what we saw last night from Tesla. And I think that in and of itself is, like, a definitive throwing the gauntlet down moment that we are 100% far and away the leaders in humanoid robotics.
For sure. 100%. Dude, like, they literally already replaced bartenders for their events. You really think Tesla's going to have a bartender moving forward, like a human bartender now for their parties? Hell no. They're gonna start using the humanoid robots, and those humanoid robots are going to be the ones serving drinks. And they're going to collect the data from those events, because that is very useful information. Like, Tesla almost has an incentive to host more parties. Like, Tesla has an incentive now to, like, bring people into, like, something they host, and whatever tasks are done by the human or robot, you know.
Well, most of that incentive is marketing. Like, you know, operating the Optimus bartender costs them more than having a, you know, hiring a human bartender. But
data gathering.
The amount of attention and yeah, the data gathering that you get is next level.
Yeah. It pays for itself in like a second. Like I would argue that like if someone from Tesla's listening, figure out a way to host an event once a month that the Tesla robot will be able to do those tasks and use those as data gathering things. Even if it's like send a bot to every Tesla store and just have them help you around, greet people at the door, like bring them swag.
Dude, that is an awesome use case right there.
Yeah. Like, why not? Like, that's what's going to happen. This is what I'm talking about. Like, even if it's teleoperated, bro, like just have the person sit in Texas or Palo Alto. And then when the bot gets into trouble, beam into it. We already have high-speed internet everywhere. The ping's going to be like 50 milliseconds at max. It's like you playing Call of Duty or Overwatch and trying to cap some heads, bro. Like just have people nearby so that the ping isn't that high. It's like literally playing a video game. Hey, Tesla from, you know, bot from, you know, Springfield service center is having an issue. Okay, what's the issue? I don't know how to open this door. Okay, open the door. And then just do that constantly and have those bots just bring parts in the shop. Like I said, greet people at the door. There's so many use cases they can use right now with this bot that are not just like data gathering tools, but it actually brings a tangible improvement to the business. You know? And you can do that now. Ish, right?
Yeah, the question
when I say
is,
now, I mean within the next 6 to 12 months. But yeah.
Yeah, the question is what's the headcount that you have to add to teleoperate? And you know, if it's one human per bot, then I don't think Elon's gonna want to spend the money to do that at a mass scale out level. If it's less than that, then perhaps. I mean,
one human per bot works because you start at one human per bot with say 100 bots, and then you say we're not ramping the program until you're able to do 2 bots per human, and then 3 bots per human. Right. So you allow the groundwork to begin, and then the use case is we cap the hiring at 100. And then from that point forward, if you want to manufacture more bots, you better make it work with 100 people. You know, I can see why this is missed from the event because it is esoteric and it's insane. It's dumb. It makes no sense that a future of humanoid robots is already technically possible, you know? And it shouldn't be a surprise that the company that their expertise is having state-of-the-art manufacturing systems has figured out how to make the supply chain and the manufacturing system work for a humanoid robot, which has a lot of parts that are interchangeable with a car, if you really think about it, as Elon Musk explained previously. You just have to, it's the puzzle. You just got to puzzle them so that you put them in a humanoid form factor. And then their job is like, okay, how do we ramp this sucker up? Oh, we need a new hand. Okay, just replace the freaking forearm with a new hand. Have the power electronics be able to support that new thing or whatever. Oh, we need to replace the arms. Okay, replace the arms. Oh, we need a new bot. Okay, make a new bot. It's like, okay, it's there. Like they can do it.
Yeah, I was just looking at how many stores, it looks like, according to Perplexity, I, you know, haven't
like 400
clicked all the links, but yeah, it says 236 Tesla stores in the US and then like 438 globally. So, you know, if there was one per store there, the question that you have at that point is, you know, is it, do you get ROI from the work and the data? Like what's the highest quality data that you can collect? And then what's the highest value work that you can do? Most people kind of think that the factory work, and instead of, you know, deploying them to stores, even though that would be cool for customers, that they'll probably get deployed to factory jobs first because it's lower variability. And if they can offset, you know, the work that a human would do that they're having to pay a lot for, that, you know, they'll get more value out of it there first. I think I do agree. So I think we're thinking similarly. I don't think Elon's going to want to hire, you know, thousands and thousands of teleoperators.
No.
So he's not going to want to ramp up the production of them while the ratio of, you know, operators to bots is one. but he will certainly start a group when it is at that level and max it out and, you know,
cap it,
push the system. Yeah. Like push the limits, do all the experimentation. And then once they solve those problems and challenges, move on to the next iteration and scale up the system.
Yeah, for sure. I think that is the most obvious thing for them to do, you know, I believe. And like the question of like, okay, so can you get an ROI on this thing already? Then say like a service scenario, just having a person in the shop that's able to bring parts to the car, you know, that they're working on, even if it's like nuts, bolts, anything that's less than 50 pounds, which is a surprising amount of parts in the car, trim, panels, even maybe like a lot of door panels, I don't think are over 50 pounds. They're pretty light, to be honest.
Pretty much anything except for electric motors, big castings,
battery seats
and wheels
are going to be clunky. But even with the seats, bro, just use the jack, just because those seats are on a pallet. You know, I know this because I was in freaking supply chain. Just take the freaking pallet jack, like the bot can do that. Dude, literally, this is crazy. Of course you can do this. And then all of a sudden, like your throughput for service goes up tremendously because you don't have a lot of that wasted, you know, that path that you have to go from car to part, or like, you know, you gotta bring all the parts there and then work on it or whatever. Just have the bot do it for you. And you can almost have it like just diagnose, and then, you know, the bot starts bringing stuff in and it brings it in the order that you're going to use it. And so you can start work right away. There's just so many things you can do. Dude, I'm like, damn it. I wish I was in a warehouse setting again so I can do all this. You know, like their parts distribution network is going to massively benefit from this. Like all small part picking is going to be done by the bot. And I would argue you would create a completely separate process for the small part picking. You could just literally anything that's less than 50 pounds, have it be its own process and have that entire thing be run by bots. The picking, the packing, the staging, the loading, even the receiving. I would have your receiving trucks be sorted in that way so you can process them fully by the bot. It's like, do not send me mixed trucks that my bot can do all the work. Only send me trailers where the parts are only the parts that the bot can do, and then assign two dock doors in the warehouse that are specifically for the bot, and make part of the warehouse just be for the bot, you know, slot it, inventory it exactly for the bot, and then literally just give them that little corner and just make it automated and just fucking have them work.
And then you just grow that, you know, month after month, year after year, until it goes from two dock doors to every single one. And exactly. Like whatever extra tooling that you have to bring in to assist the bots in, you know, handling those things that are larger, you just do that.
Yeah.
Like, why this not? Is obviously the long, you know, how long does it take us to accomplish that? I don't know. Like, it's not tomorrow, but it's
next year.
Probably in the next few years at some point. I think next year.
Teleoperator for sure. 1,000%. Dude, if I was still at Tesla with my friend Greg, like we ran a lot of these kinds of programs where we're trying to automate the systems, but we didn't have fucking bots at our disposal. Like right now, if I was at Tesla, I would go to Greg. I'd be like, Greg, figure out how to get us 5 bots. Just figure it out, you know? And he was my boss. I'd be like, Greg. And he'd be like, I've already called him. Yeah. I'm already on it. Dude, we try to get Tesla semis for our process, and they kept saying no, we can't, because the cost opportunity with shipping batteries from Nevada to Fremont is better than y'all's toy of trying to move parts around the country. I'm like, wow, thanks for thinking of us that way, you fucking that was literally
what we were, are like, we the, just like, the number to you.
Yeah, we were the redheaded stepchildren. Supply chain, welcome to supply chain. That's literally it. Like, we get passed on because of manufacturing all the time. Yeah, so like there is just, but now this is what Tesla's going to say. Tesla's going to say, I already can tell you what they're going to say. We're not going to use it in supply chain because this is way more valuable in manufacturing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they're going to say. Yeah. So like that use case is, perhaps you're right, years away, but the use case of using a bot to do human labor through teleoperation to start. Yeah.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're right. You're right. It's just See, this is my optimism coming through, because I'm like literally like, this works now. this works now. I know it works.
Oh, and you're right. Like, it does. So the question is, when will it work for what? And it's all, you know, it's all measured in dollars and cents. Like, yes. The most valuable tasks that require the least from, you know, it's like two independent variables. It's like, how hard is it for the bot to do this job? And then how much money does the bot make doing this job? And the things that are like super easy for the bot to do that make it a lot of money are the first places that it gets deployed.
Yeah.
And like there's so many of, you know, this is what Scott Walter refers to as like the low hanging fruit. That's just like laying. He's like, it's not even on the trees. Like, this is the fruit that's on the ground waiting to be picked. And it's literally just rotting. And there's so much of this latent demand in the economy for tasks that people want to do, but they can't pay a human to do because it's like, if you could pay to have task X done and like you would pay $5 an hour to do it, it would get done. But at above $5 an hour, then it doesn't get done. There's tons and tons and tons and tons of that work. And a lot of that work is actually that stuff that's super, super simple. And, so there's a couple of like that work will eventually get done as we scale up the amount of bots that there are. But there is also stuff that's, you know, either really dangerous. Like there are things that are really easy to do, but it's really dangerous for a human to do them. And because it's really dangerous for a human to do them, you have to pay humans a butt ton of money to do them.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether that's partly because you're mitigating safety risks or because it's, you know, hazardous in the first place, like all kinds of things, then those are your, you know, first most important use cases to apply the bot to. And that's why they, you know, say you're trying to attack the dull, dirty, and dangerous, especially the dangerous tasks to begin with. And so, there's so much that stuff. It's just going to start there and then it's going to cascade through everything.
I would argue that the dull stuff is probably even easier because the use case is simple. Like the dangerous stuff usually involves complexity because it's like you have to get into a space, or maybe getting to the space is easy-ish, but like just being in that space is what makes it dangerous, right? But dude, like staging product in a warehouse. Okay, just like literally staging and loading in a warehouse is a task that exists in most warehouses that are not fully automated, and Amazon and maybe a couple other players are the few ones that can do that, right? Like it takes a lot of investment in CapEx. You need a lot of demand to be able to justify full automation in a warehouse. Like it costs a lot of money. You have to essentially craft your process to non-human robots for it to work, right? But literally just like bringing part from point A to point B is a job right now in a warehouse setting that exists that companies pay $15 to $20 an hour. That exists now in that setting. And imagine how many other jobs like that. Dude, in a construction site, bringing dirt from one point to another using a wheelbarrow as an example. Or just the movement of product from point A to point B is a job that humans pay anywhere between $5 an hour at the very low end to $20, $25, $30 an hour. Those are immediately disrupted by this, teleoperated or not. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the first places are probably going to be combinations of like dull and dangerous. So it's like, dull is a thing, dangerous is a thing, dirty is a thing. And then there are some things that are dull, dirty, and dangerous.
Yeah.
And like that is a perfect use case where it's dull, you know, it doesn't require any real thinking on the part of the person doing the job, but it is dirty and, you know, maybe it's dangerous because it's dirty, or maybe it's dangerous and dirty, like whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Like those are
good points.
Huge prime use cases. Things that are like you're talking about are dull and, you know,
somewhat
depending
dangerous
on the weight of the things that you're transporting. They are dangerous because they require that repetition and those, you know, doing large numbers of those repetitive, dull tasks is actually harmful to, you know, your health or your body.
There's also like the intermingling with machinery too. Like, you know, you're walking around forklifts, you're walking around pallet riders. Like you are walking through, you know, racks where maybe a pallet could be misplaced and it falls. Right. Yep. These are not like, that's why HIPAA. I'm sorry. That's why
OSHA.
Thank you. That's why OSHA exists, is that literally people died because pallets fall from the racks. It's crazy stuff, right? So, no, I think that you make an excellent point. Okay, so the bot obviously is like ridiculous, completely ridiculous. But can we hit RoboTaxi? The design of it is insane. I love the design of it so much. So I think, in my opinion, if I can bring this up real quick, what Tesla has done with the profile design of this car, meaning like from the side, that is the most beautiful car they've ever made. That is stunning. That is a stunning design. And the reason why it's so stunning is the proportions of it are the proportion of the front hood to the rear is like, you know, 1/3, 2/3. It almost follows like a Fibonacci type like inspiration, this curve right here, right? And it's obviously made to be incredibly aerodynamic. This tail, right, that teardrop, it's like it's got that beautiful teardrop shape that Porsches are known for, right? The Porsche is like a reverse teardrop, right? This is like almost got like a forwards teardrop where the bulb end of the teardrop is facing forward. But and I highly doubt that rim protector is going to be in the production. I think they're doing that for show, because God help you if you hit a pothole. That thing's going to be coming, you know, kind of come flying right off completely. So they're probably going to shorten the wall for sure. But number one, the design is incredible. Like I just love, absolutely love the way it looks. Okay.
Do you think that the production version will have those larger wheels in the, like those rear wheels are significantly larger than the front wheels, which definitely adds to the aesthetics of the whole thing. Like, it looks mean with those giant rear wheels. Yes. I think they're 21s in the back and 19s in the front. They're freaking huge.
Yeah. Okay. Why would they put a 21-inch wheel on a self-driving car? What is that?
I don't know. This is the exact reason I'm asking the question, because it doesn't
make
intuitive sense to me. I'm sure that there's reasons, and I don't know what they are yet.
I mean, what it could... Okay, so here's a theory. So you know this like airless tire that they're working on? The more space you have between the rim and the end of the tire, the more cushion you can provide on a tire that doesn't have standard air. The reason why you can have a 21-inch tire with a very short wall is because you have air. Because you have air in there, because it compresses and goes back. But if you're trying to do it with an airless tire, you're never going to be able to do it with 21-inch rims and a wall that's this short. That would be, it'd be literally like driving on rocks. You like just might as well drive on a stone tire, because it doesn't matter how soft you can make the rubber, it's not going to have nearly as much play as air, right? But if you make a lot of space between the rim and the tire, maybe it's like a 14-inch rim with a 21-inch tire equivalent, right? All of a sudden, you go from having a decently sized wall to like maybe double, and that's what allows the car to have the cushion with an airless.
And that may
tire.
Explain those solid caps too,
right? Yeah, that's one theory. That's one theory, you know, because maybe like, okay, and here's the reasoning behind it. I mean, it's obvious, right? An airless tire, the amount of times you're gonna have to replace that rare, right? As long as you have a compound that can work in different weather conditions and it has a long life, if you're able to achieve that, then no nail, no pothole, nothing short of not even maybe an accident will cause the tire to deform or break or whatever it may be, right? I've had, since I've moved to Austin, Texas in 2020, I've had 5 different nails in my tires, in 5 different tires. I had to replace my entire set of tires because of nails. And then after I replaced them, you know, success, like whenever it happened, I got another one. And there, it's always in a different tire. It's always, it's like a front left, rear left, rear, whatever it is, okay? And these are, and I have 21s on my Model Y, okay? Each tire is $600, bro, with like replacing it. So like doing that with this is dumb. It's dumb if they have the rim that matches that tire size, right? But if they don't, and these tires can go 500,000 miles without a replacement, okay, that makes perfect sense. That makes perfect, perfect sense. So it could also,
you know, yeah, they probably have plenty of data on that as well. Like how often people are having to do service on their tires. And that's a significant concern, you know, if you're owning these vehicles and operating them as a commercial fleet.
Yeah. The last thing you want is your robotaxi to like, you know, run into a nail. I mean, dude, human, I miss nails. Obviously. I miss nails all the time, and I consider myself to be a relatively good driver. It's not like I'm hunting for nails on the asphalt when the nail is the same color of the asphalt. Like, you're going to miss that for sure. The other thing could be, too, is that maybe it is a traditional wheel tire combination, right? And that traditional wheel tire combination is behind the idea that this form factor, this design, ultimately is going to be the compact car. And that the shape of the vehicle and how they're designing it will be one where people will be able to buy. And they will offer it like any other car, since you can buy steering wheel and pedal with it. Let's say that's the theory behind this car as well. Maybe it's like, hey, like you'll be able to buy it with 21s. And it's going to look sick. And you'll be able to drive it. But by the way, if you don't want to drive it, it will also drive itself. You just have to pay more for tires. But if you ever decide to move to the, and just never have to worry about your tires, we also offer the airless option that you can put on your car. And that airless option goes right in, right? You can just swap out the entire rim and tire, and then you go. And like allowing enough room for that tire to be there so that you can have that comfortable ride without it feeling like you're riding on stone or whatever, on stone tires, then that allows that to exist. So I don't know.
I still have a hard time thinking through why the front and the back would be different sizes. You know, the airless versus air tire, like they could still be the same size as, you know, the fronts and the backs being airless tires. I like what you're saying about the airless tires as far as the fleet operations use case. But yeah, like I don't know if this was a design decision made for mostly aesthetic reasons or, you know, whether it's mostly functional. Maybe it's 30% functional and 70% design. I mean, it looks so good. And like, I think there's a significant, like that in and of itself can be the reason. Like Elon drove the Starman like spacesuit design so hard to be sexy looking, even though it was super difficult. And this was something that I posted today. Like somebody had here, let's see if I can find it, posted pictures of, you know, both a Waymo and this robotaxi next to each other. This thing pulls up, like if you have the option of two robotaxis sitting there and they're both going to get you to this place that you're going to go for the same money and they're both the same safety, like are you going to get in this one or are you going to get in this one? Like unless you needed the four-door version, of course you would get in this one.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself, like I think the vast majority of people will gravitate towards the one that just looks better, cooler. Like, you mean I get to sit in a car that looks kind of like a McLaren F1 and, you know,
in a Porsche,
get driven around? Yeah. Like versus what the heck is this wart covered thing? Like, what?
Yeah. And what's good, what's even funnier is that that better looking one, that the one that even the biggest Tesla hater will be incapable of saying that this is not a phenomenal design, like an all-time great design, truly. That one is probably going to be half the price of Waymo if Tesla really wanted it to be. If they wanted to bypass supply demand dynamics and they just say, okay, we want to make 30%, like you said, you know, your examples you were giving out on the previous podcast, right? Or the ones that Pierre was talking about. If you want to make 30% margin, Tesla can probably charge half of Waymo and Waymo would still not be able to make a profit. Okay? It's unbelievable. So now the jury is out on that robotaxi, which I'm stuck on. And there's multiple ones. I mean, we can probably save the discussion around like profitability and stuff for a different time. But like where I'm really, really stuck is if Tesla's planning on coming out with a cheaper vehicle in the first half of next year, which they gave guidance on their quarterly report, which they wouldn't have done unless they were truly trying to do that, right? Why on earth would you create a different production line for that product when all you have to do with this is add a steering wheel, pedals, side view mirrors, and maybe a smaller screen? Everything else in that vehicle, it has everything you need for it to be street legal now. Even with steer by wire, okay? Steer by wire allows you to connect the steering wheel to the front wheels without doing much, okay? You don't have to do that much.
I think you're describing an ongoing heated argument between Elon Musk and Franz von Holzhausen and yes. Lars Moravi and like...
Yes. Why?
The back and forth.
Why wouldn't you do that? Like, why wouldn't you know? And I get it. Like, Matthew's I'm a big fan of Matthew. And I know he spoke with Lars and Front, and they said there's no plans to do a version of the robotaxi with steering wheel and pedals. But what I'm describing is not the robotaxi. What I'm describing is the compact car that happens to be the robotaxi. Okay? It's two different products. Like, it blows. There is no, okay. The marrying of the production and the jurisdictions that are going to allow this to truly be capable to drive without a steering wheel and pedal for the foreseeable future, there's probably no more. Like even let's fast forward to 2030. I highly doubt that we're going to have enough jurisdictions allowing this type of vehicle on the roads that will surpass anything more at the maximum of a 50,000 per year run rate for this vehicle, okay? And if your plan is to make millions of units per year of this thing long-term, okay, why wouldn't you leverage that exact line to get to, and again, this is like we were talking about before, what is Tesla very good at? Monetizing their products as they get finalized, right? They're doing that with FSD. They're probably going to do that with a bot. This would be the same exact thing. Just get it in the hands of customers with a steering wheel and pedal where you can ramp the production line to millions of units per year. I mean, this thing will be the best-selling car in the world five times over, and they don't even have to announce that it launched. They just have to throw it on the website for 35,000 or whatever the number is, right?
So... even if that is the exact plan, of course Lars and Franz are going to say that that's not the plan. They literally can't say that that's the plan, even if it is. So I don't think we know that that's not the plan.
I agree. It makes no sense that it's not the plan.
Well, I was going to say it makes so much sense that if it's not the plan,
Elon's lost
and
it.
Elon, no, like. If it's not the plan, it's because Elon has a really, really good reason. And he knows exactly what are all of the failure modes that could wipe out whatever that other plan is. And if they're continuing forward with the plan, it's because they have mitigated all the failure modes.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I don't think that's the case. Because again, you're still beholden to the jurisdictions that will allow you to operate this. You could have, this could be done tomorrow. Okay. I don't see how you're going to have enough jurisdictions turned on for this to actually be justified in the millions of units of production run rate per year. Anytime this decade, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless he's literally talked to every government official and they're all like, we have it in paper that we will do this by here if you can prove that you can do it. And yeah, knowing, I just don't see how that's possible. That feels harder than making this have steering wheel and pedals.
I'm going to say it,
Hans. This is the compact car. And I'm probably wrong. This is the compact car. It's just they don't want to say it's a compact car.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. I've been saying that for, well, maybe not that specifically, but close to that. Yeah. I was like, I've been saying for a long time that what they show us on 1010, you know, I was saying this before 882, like what they were going to show us at this event was going to be no steering wheel, no pedals. And they were not going to say anything about the same version with steering wheel and pedals because, you know, they can't Osborne their thing. Now, there's only like we already know there's steering wheel and pedals cars, that those cars are coming out in the first half of 25, and that those cars are very closely related to whatever the cars are that they're building today. So the question is there then between those cars and full cyber cab another in between step? And that, I think, really depends on how well step one goes. Like, we won't really know what the likelihood is of that for a little while. On the regulatory approval side of things, I think that there is one very easy strategy. If the economics are as ridiculous as they look like, that makes adoption of these things like that. And that you say, we're going to propose to city council to add a robo taxi service tax, and the city is going to generate, like, is going to get 5 cents for every dollar of revenue from every robo taxi ride. Poof.
So, like, you're talking about the same government that didn't employ Starlink to do broadband internet.
Yeah, the government wasn't. I'm talking about offering cities specifically, which are tax starved.
Yeah.
A giant cash asset. Like, yeah. I know so many cities that in this area that are really struggle to provide the services, the municipal services that they're supposed to provide with the budgets that they have. They just don't have the tax base for it.
Yeah. That's a great point. You know, and the other thing too is like, so like for this to work as a compact car, okay, the castings you're going to need for them are going to be significantly different than the castings that are being made for Model 3 and Y, very obviously, right? And if their thing is like, hey, we're going to leverage our existing lines to come out with more affordable models, right? For this to be the more affordable model next year to be the compact, they, like, what is the likelihood that they're able to modify their casting process so that it spits out these casts and not the other casts? How customizable are those casting machines? Do we know?
Yeah, no, that's actually pretty, they already do something like that where, you know, the same machine is used for the front castings and the rear castings, and so they they run a whole bunch of fronts, then they take out the molds, they put in different molds, and they're not actually called molds, they're called dies, but you know, the part that's the negative of the shape, and then they run, you know, the other thing. And so you can, you know, if you've got big enough ones, like one of the things that's likely, if the castings on these are small enough is that you could, you may not want to have them connected, but you could have a front casting and a rear casting come out of the same die shot together. So you could, in one overall, you know, casting cycle, produce both the front casting and the rear casting. The reason that you would want to keep them separate is so that then they could go on through a more unboxed process as separate sub-assemblies. If you're putting it on the current lines, maybe you do make it all one casting from front to back.
Yeah.
And it just proceeds right on down your regular assembly line. And you could probably, you know, cast the entire underbody of the Cybercab with the same machine that you're currently using to cast the castings for the Cybertruck.
So if I look at this image, right, that, dude, this car looks so good in every angle. It's like unbelievable the design that they've done with this thing. Even with like everything.
Franz,
like,
is a master.
He's insane. Franz, if you're watching this, can you please come on the podcast, bro? Like, we really need to figure out how, like, what, like, how did you do this? Okay. So how big is this car? Like, do we have shots of it next to, like, the 3 and the Y and stuff? What's the likelihood that you can just do this whole car in one die?
Oh, I think it's super, like, the casting machine that they're using for Cybertruck can almost guaranteed cast the entire underbody of the Cybercab in one thing. Like, I don't know that they're, even going back to what I was saying about potentially doing it as a single piece casting, I still don't think they would even do that, because it's just better to use the structural battery pack as the structural member in between the front and the back. But like I said, you could either, you know, there are engineers whose job it's going to be to figure out, is it better to do a mold where you could do multiple front castings all together? And so then you just run a whole bunch of fronts and then you switch and you do a whole bunch of backs. And maybe you can, you know, maybe you could do, like, if the front casting is significantly smaller than the back casting, you may be able to do 3 front castings in a single and 2 back castings in a single shot. You know, they'll run down the decision tree of, you know, what's the fastest, cheapest, most economical way to make the castings. But, you know, 100% a Cybertruck size, you know, casting machine can do at least an entire Cybercab underbody in a single shot.
What about the whole thing that Elon's always talked about? Is like, hey, I want to make cars like they make Matchbox cars. I just want them to come out whole. Like, what's the complexity there?
The unbox process kind of went away from that idea, and, you know, trying to keep things as separate for as long as possible is, I mean, I guess there is a slight outside chance that something like that is what they are doing for this in between step, where they're trying to use the current lines, that maybe they have, they're doing some bigger castings, and it just makes it really hard to work around. So if you think about the image from the presentation where they had the whole car and they had 4 people around the whole car, and how inefficient that was compared to having 4 people standing around the, just like the front casting sub-assembly.
Yeah.
It just makes it harder to access all of the different things that you need to access while you're doing individual sub-assemblies.
Got it. Okay. But it is possible to make the castings for this car with the existing equipment. Like, without a shadow of a doubt.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's just figuring out how to make it flow through your assembly process. And getting it so that it's compatible with the 3 and Y line.
And the assembly process is way more important to get right than, you know, how much of it is cast.
For sure. Okay.
Or what the shape of that casting is specifically.
How long does it usually take between them getting the alpha prototypes out and doing the first production unit sold? Is that usually like 6 to 9 months, if you remember correctly? Like how often, like when we're looking at Cybertruck, how long did it take from it to go from seeing it on the road to the first foundation series rolled off the line and actually was sold to a customer?
I think 6 to 9 months does sound about right. Okay. We'd have to look at specific dates, but that sounds right. And I think it sounds right for some of the previous ones. And then Cybertruck was especially hard. Like, I don't think that Cybercab is going to necessarily be as difficult to go from the release candidates to the first production.
I think it's going to be stupid easy. It has to be stupid easy by design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a video that people should probably go watch. I'm not going to try and summarize it here because I haven't actually got to see all of it. But that Brian White from Futuraza put together this morning about, you know, ways they engineered cost out of the Cybercab. And we'll just use one example here that he also talked about on our stream this morning, about the fact that there was no window switches in the doors because they tried to remove as much wiring from the doors as possible and as much electronics from the door as possible. And so the switches to raise and lower the windows are actually in the center console. They're not in the doors. And that simplifies the complexity.
Brilliant.
And so like they're thinking through all of these things already. They're already making some. One of the things that I don't think is that I don't think that the body panels that they had made were likely to be made of the same material and using the same manufacturing process as they will be eventually. Like, I don't think they have the tooling yet to make. So I think those were custom built with a, you know, a hand built process that's not the scalable process for the body panels, which will mean that, you know, I don't know. I've asked so far, no one has touched the actual body panels that I've spoken to yet from the event. And so I'm going to continue to try to do that, but we don't know, like, are they plastic? Are they metal? Are they painted? Are they like, what is all that stuff? Even if we did have that information on what it was at the event last night, I don't know that that would be a guarantee that that is what we end up seeing on the final version. I still think that there's a decent chance that the exterior ends up being stainless steel, but significantly thinner stainless steel than is on the Cybertruck, because really? The Cybertruck is so hard. Like, you could go significantly thinner than the Cybertruck, and it would still be a pain in the butt to stamp and form, compared to something like aluminum, but it would be doable. And the reason that I say this is because the innards of the Cybertruck doors are also stainless steel, and those are stamped and formed in curved and complex shapes. And so if they can do it with the innards of the doors, it's just not like they couldn't achieve the toughness of the Cybertruck with stainless steel that was that thin. You know, that stainless steel that's on the innards of those doors is not bulletproof. And so that desire to make the Cybertruck bulletproof, I think, is the thing that makes it into this truck that ends up being origami shaped, because it can't be bent and formed. But that's not to say that bending and forming isn't possible. It is possible because they're doing it. It's just, you know, you can't have a bulletproof stainless steel exterior if you make it thin enough to do that. Well, no one cares if the Cybercab is bulletproof. I'm sure someone cares, but not that many people. That's not what they're designing this for. And so I think it is entirely possible that that ends up being just stainless steel.
You know what it reminds me of? This color. Are you familiar with E-Coat?
Yeah.
the protective layer they put on the car before the paint so that it protects the metal. It just reminds me of an e-coated car that has some sort of protective material over it. It doesn't have to be paint. And so my head goes to, so it's like, okay, we know that
almost
stainless,
like a metallic flecked e-coat.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so in my head's like, okay, so what is one way of removing the paint shop? One of them is going stainless steel, but we know stainless, for stainless steel to have curves and to have these shapes, it's a pain in the ass, right? And so this car, we think that the underlying reason that like the reason, like the biggest reason they would make this is like the biggest variable here is to ensure that the manufacturing process is as painless as humanly possible. And so when I think about stainless steel, I think introducing that process is going to make it complex for no reason. That's the way I view it, right? Like in every situation, I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, making a stainless steel car is going to be significantly more difficult than making a non-stainless steel car, especially in this day
and age. Except for paint. Yeah. So like,
except for paint. Right.
And that is, I think, a major factor for a robotaxi. Like paint, paint repair, paint maintenance on a commercial taxi becomes a significant pain in the butt. An e-coat, you know, it's not paint, but the manufacturing process for e-coat is very similar to paint, you know, similar complexity, similar cost, similar challenges. And that was what they were trying to get away from for the Cybertruck with stainless steel. And it made sense in that specific use case. I don't know for sure if it makes sense for the robotaxi, but I think it is one of the possibilities. And I think, you know, that specific factor about trying, like having someone run into it with a shopping cart and ding the side of it, like if you can brush that out with a Brillo pad and poof, you're all good. Yeah. Like that saves you a lot of cost, you know, in the long run, trying to maintain your vehicle.
Yeah. And so, okay. And this is my last question. And I gotta step out because I got my parents coming in about a couple hours and I still gotta do a few things. Okay. If this was Robotaxi, why do they have windows? Why do they have windows in the places a regular car has windows? Why not just, like, why do you need to look to the side? Why do you need to look to the front? You're not going to be, oh my God, right? You know what? Like, people are going to be in, like, are they really going to do that? Like, do we really think people are going to do that when they're in there? No, they're going to look at the screen. They're going to be on their phone. Maybe they are able to, you know, they will be able to look outside. But why make it so traditional? Why make it so traditional?
Well, pull up a picture of the Robovan and let's...
Exactly.
Double click on this point a little bit further.
Exactly. Thank you. That's exactly my point. Like, why are you going so ham on one and not the other? It's literally the same use case. This dude, the more I look at this Robovan, the more I'm like, what the fuck? Like,
can you imagine seeing a caravan of those things driving down the interstate? It would look like a legit Art Deco train, like just powering down the interstate.
Yeah, that's the vision for an autonomous future right here. Like, this is what it's supposed to look like. Okay, so why not do the same thing with the
robot? There's no windshield there. Like,
yeah,
you don't have some rando person like sticking his head over in the corner where they have a little bit of glass so that he can drive. Like,
exactly. Yeah, why are you so concerned, dude? Why are you so concerned all of a sudden about ensuring that you have windows? Yeah, like why is this quarter panel here? What is that? Why do you have that there? It makes no sense. That's a stupid place to put a window. Why would you put it there? This is the compact car. I can't wait to be wrong, but this is the compact car. And Hans has been saying this forever. This is Hans's point.
I'll try and steel man the opposing argument. Okay. One of them is that, you know, this is an incredibly sexy car, but also it is heavily inspired by the Model 3 and the Model Y. Like, you can see so many similarities. And given like all the design and styling cues, like, this is a logical next step vehicle building on both the supply chains that you already have for the Model 3 and the Model Y, but also the styling cues. Like, this screams, I'm a Tesla. And the Robovan, while insane, does not scream, I'm a Tesla. So, you know, maybe it has to do with continuity. Maybe, and you know, the other thing is, this is going to be the first of the fully autonomous vehicles. And maybe that, you know, they don't want to go all the way, you know, steampunk future for, or I guess not steampunk, but Art Deco. Like, they don't want to go full balls to the wall on absolute crazy, like, no visibility. This is an easier transition platform than something where, bro, you can't even see.
But dude, this isn't even that controversial for a car. This is just a beautiful car. Like, any automaker can do this. Any, like, if Toyota came out with this and they'd be like, this is our new Corolla, but it's a two-seater, they'd be like, wow, I am not freaked out at all, because it looks so much like a car, right? Like, I would argue that they've done nothing to make this into a robot. Like, it doesn't, like, just the way the doors open, maybe. But literally, the only reason it's a robotaxi is what it does inside, not even outside. And again, like, if that, like, bro, just remove that little window right there. Just remove that. Just, like, you get rid of that, and that right there is a clue that says, okay, they don't, like, who's gonna look back there? Who's gonna look back there unless you need to see who's behind you when you're making a merge, or you're doing a U-turn? Come on, come on, come on. Dude, I'm going to look like such an idiot when it's totally not that. okay. I got to go.